On August 10th, 1994, Korean passenger plane flight 2033 from Seoul to Jeju, South Korea, approached the runway for landing. It was going faster than usual because the winds of an approaching typhoon gave the plane an extra push. Captain was flying the plane, the pilot was in control, but 50 feet above the runway, the co-pilot decided there was not enough runway left to land the plane. So he tried to take over the controls and perform a go-around against the captain's wishes. He wanted to circle the plane around and attempt another landing. The aircraft touched down almost 6,000 feet beyond the runway threshold, so it simply could not be stopped on the remaining length of the runway. The plane struck a safety barricade, and all 160 passengers and crew escaped to safety just moments before the plane burst into flames. 2 days later, on August 12, 1994, an article appeared in the Los Angeles Times entitled, "Pilot, Co-pilot Blame Each Other in South Korean Crash." The Times article said this: the pilot and co-pilot blamed each other Thursday for a crash that destroyed a Korean Air jet liner. Both were jailed on suspicion that they had caused the accident by quarreling during landing. An officer investigating Wednesday's crash said the Canadian pilot and the South Korean co-pilot disagreed over what to do when the plane touched the runway after the flight from Seoul. The co-pilot basically wanted to take off again in view of the short length in the runway, left in the runway while the pilot, however, believed he had enough distance to bring the plane to a halt in time, the police officer said. In the struggle to control the plane, the Airbus A300 skidded and rammed a safety barricade. According to other news reports, the pilot and the co-pilot had gotten into a fist fight over who was in charge of the landing controls. We might say these guys had control issues. Might even call them control freaks. Around a decade ago, on the Oprah Winfrey Show, there was a story about a couple where a wife had some serious control issues. She told her husband how to comb his hair. She told him what he could eat and what he could not eat. She kept a calendar to see how he was doing in different areas so she could keep tabs on everything he did. She had notebooks full of rules, such as fold your jeans in half, fold mine in thirds. Stop. One of her rules was, never give yourself anything without asking me what I want first. Sometimes the word Gentile was used in the New Testament not only to indicate people who were not Jews. It was sometimes used to represent the ungodly. In Matthew 6, verses 31 and 32, regarding placing too much concern on food and clothing, Jesus said, therefore do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. Jesus was not saying that no Jew ever worried about these things. Jesus was talking to a crowd of Jews. He was saying, don't act like people who don't know God. In Matthew 20, verse 25, Jesus said that it is the Gentiles who see power and strength as being able to rule and dominate others. That's what gives you, that's what strength is about. That's what elevates you. The contemporary English version quotes that or translates Matthew 20, 25 as, you know that foreign rulers like to order their people around. But Jesus said it should not be so among you because you should be servants. Worldly people consider importance as connected with power. The ungodly think that controlling others is the hallmark of greatness. It should be different in the church. Christians should not be control freaks, and I kind of don't like using that. That sounds a little demeaning, a little condescending, but that's a popular term. We'll see it more in just a second from a psychological perspective. Everyone, all of us, try to control things to some degree. We try to regulate our relationships. We communicate with each other in order to understand each other and in order to make things go more smoothly, to control the atmosphere, the environment, the relationship in that sense. All that's necessary to have a healthy and wholesome relationship, but too much focus, too much effort to control, to regulate others is not only ineffective, it's also harmful to others and harmful to ourselves. And the slang of psychology, the colloquial term control freak, was first used in the 1970s. In the May 2017 edition of Psychology Today magazine, there was an article entitled Seven Signs of a Control Freak. The article stated that many people who go into therapy with depression, anxiety, and stress-related issues have one thing in common. They spend a lot of time focusing on things they cannot control. They waste time, the article goes on to say, trying to convince others to change. They're busy, but they don't feel effective, and that's because they put their energy into the wrong places. Rather than controlling their emotions, they always try to control the environment around them and the people in it. According to the article, three of the signs of a control freak are they invest a lot of time in trying to convince other people to change. The article said most control freaks believe they know what is best for everyone, and they try to convince other people to do things differently, whether they lecture, whether when they become aggressive or manipulate things behind the scenes, the goal is to make other people act a certain way. One of the other points, they have trouble maintaining meaningful relationships. The article continues, no one ever says, you know what I like about her? She's a control freak. Control freaks repel people with demands and unsolicited advice. Number three, they lack compassion for people who make mistakes. They think people who have serious struggles need to just get over it. Whenever they do admit to problems or failures or struggles of their own, they usually drag other people in with them. I needed your help. If you had done more. The first sentence in the conclusion of the article says, control freaks experience consequences ranging from constant irritability to uncontrollable anger. And is there any wonder why? In another article from October 2010 in Psychology Today, the author writes, controllers obsessively try to dictate how you're supposed to be and feel. They have an opinion about everything, and you disagree with them at your peril. They'll control you by invalidating your emotions if those don't fit into their rule book. Whether they are spouting unsolicited advice or using anger to put you in your place, their comments range from irritating to abusive. What's most infuriating about these people is that they usually don't see themselves as controlling. They only see themselves as right. They control through manipulation, intimidation, passive-aggressive behaviors, pressure, dominance, anger, criticism, etc., etc. Where did all this business of control come from, anyway? Is this some modern phenomenon? Well, of course not. History is one long story of people trying to control other people. The desire to gain control goes back as far as the Garden of Eden, when the serpent said to the woman, "You shall be as God, knowing good and evil." That appealed to Eve because she wanted to be God over her life. She wanted to control her own little piece of turf. You want to be God over your little turf, and I want to be God over my little turf, and because our little turfs intersect, we sometimes can't get along. I want to control you, you want to control me. And so control lies at the heart of sin, we might say. Sin, in fact, could be spoken of as self-will. Sin is setting up my little kingdom instead of God's. Sin is being willing to do whatever it takes to maintain control over what I want and to exalt myself and to be king over my little territory, whether it's big or small. It's about dominance. It's about control. We're going to spend a few minutes looking at King Saul of the Old Testament. King Saul was initially a relatively good king. He won some tremendous battles. He received a lot of adulation. But his pride caused him to become disobedient to God. And he spent the rest of his life trying to control things over which he had no control. In 1 Samuel 13, a battle was imminent with the Philistines, and Saul and his army were waiting for sacrifices to be offered to the Lord. Since only the priest was supposed to make such an offering, King Saul was supposed to wait for Samuel. But as you recall, Samuel was late, and Saul was desperate because he feared that somehow the Philistines were going to attack before the sacrifice was offered. So he went ahead and offered the sacrifice in violation of the commandment of the Lord. When Samuel arrived and learned what Saul had done, he told King Saul in 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, "Now your kingdom must end, for the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. The Lord has already appointed him to be the leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." Sometime later, this fact is restated by Samuel after King Saul had once again blatantly disobeyed God's instructions. In 1 Samuel 15, verses 28 and 29, Samuel told Saul, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to someone else who is better than you. And he who is the glory of Israel will not lie, nor will he change his mind. For he is not human that he should change his mind." We're going to consider four signs of someone who has control issues, using Saul here as an example. First, they will refuse to relinquish control. King Saul, at this point, now begins his quest to keep control of something that God has already taken from him. Saul now is going to begin to control, or try to control, make his efforts to control David, the one whom God has given what he took from Saul, the kingdom. And so from this point on, King Saul becomes obsessed with possessing the kingdom. He's going to hold on to that kingdom until his knuckles turn white. He's going to hold on to that kingdom until the day he dies, because he will not acknowledge that God is in control. He will not acknowledge that God can give it to whomsoever he will. And so Saul is going to hold on until everything around him is destroyed. He'll take it all down if he has to, because he does not believe the kingdom belongs to God. He believes he should have control over it. He believes the kingdom belongs to himself. Another sign of one with control issues is insane jealousy. In Saul's effort to retain control, he became insanely jealous. After David killed Goliath, Saul eventually set David over his army. And reading from 1 Samuel 18, verses 6 through 9, starting in verse 5 actually, "Whatever Saul asked David to do, David did it successfully. So Saul made him a commander over the men of war, an appointment that was welcomed by the people and Saul's officers alike. When the victorious Israelite army was returning home after David had killed the Philistine, women from all the towns of Israel came out to meet King Saul. They sang and danced for joy with tambourines and cymbals. This was their song: 'Saul has killed his thousands and David his ten thousands.'" Verse 8 says, "This made Saul very angry. 'What's this?' he said. 'They credit David with ten thousands and me with only thousands. Next, they'll be making him their king.'" So from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. In Saul's effort to maintain control of the kingdom, he became paranoid. He began thinking that David was always plotting to steal the kingdom. But you know what David was doing? He was just waiting for God. He was merely being a humble servant. But people with control issues lose the ability to see things as they are. Their jealousy distorts their vision. A third characteristic of someone with control issues is obsessive anger. We continue reading in 1 Samuel 18, verses 10 through 16. We're told the very next day a tormenting spirit from God overwhelmed Saul, and he began to rave in his house like a madman. David was playing the harp as he did each day, but Saul had a spear in his hand, and he suddenly hurled it at David, intending to pin him to the wall, but David escaped him twice. Saul was then afraid of David, for the Lord was with David and had turned away from Saul. Finally, Saul sent him away and appointed him commander over 1,000 men, and David faithfully led his troops into battle. David continued to succeed in everything he did, for the Lord was with him. When Saul recognized this, he became even more afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he was so successful at leading his troops into battle. David had done nothing wrong. David was innocent. David was a loyal servant, but because of Saul's obsession to control everything, Saul hated David. He feared David. He wanted to kill David. In fact, the remainder of the book of 1 Samuel is filled with Saul's continued efforts to put David to death. The fourth characteristic of one with control issues is cunning manipulation. Once Saul realizes that he can't kill David, he tries another tactic. When rage and efforts to commit murder fail, he simply tries manipulation. 1 Samuel 18, verse 17, and then we'll go down to verses 28 through 30. Verse 17 says, "One day Saul said to David, 'I'm ready to give you my older daughter as your wife, but you must first prove yourself to be a real warrior by fighting the Lord's battles.' For Saul thought," here's what he thought within himself, "'I'll send him out against the Philistines and let them kill him rather than doing it myself.' But it became obvious that the Lord was blessing David and protecting him from harm. And so when we go down to the end of this chapter, we read verse 28 beginning, "When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and how much his daughter Michal loved him, Saul became even more afraid of him, and he remained David's enemy for the rest of his life. Every time the commanders of the Philistines attacked, David was more successful against them than all the rest of Saul's officers. So David's name became very famous." The more controlling a person becomes, the more manipulative they become, and the more distressing everything becomes, because they try to control people. They may try to set up traps for them, but like Wile E. Coyote, everything keeps blowing up in their own face. Saul spent years of his life trying to control things that were out of his control. God had taken the kingdom from Saul, and God had given that kingdom to David. But Saul worried and fretted, and he obsessively devoted himself to keeping control of that which was no longer his. And he was obsessed with trying to destroy someone that God was protecting. How's that working out for you? Influence and control are not the same things. Jesus taught that everyone has influence, and he taught that we need to use that influence for good. Matthew 5, 13 and 14, Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." We have influence, and we need to be concerned about others. And we need to seek to influence others for good. But we cross a line when we begin trying to control others. Scriptures make it clear that we are responsible for ourselves. 2 Corinthians 5, 9, and 10, therefore we make it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to him. For we all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. We're warned about trying to fix others. We're warned about trying to control others. Matthew 7, 1 through 5, judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Jesus is saying that we must first fix ourselves. We must first bring ourselves under control before we have the ability to help others with their difficulties. Luke 18, verses 10 through 14 is the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Jesus said, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Jesus said, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. The Pharisee glorified himself and criticized others. The tax collector merely asked for mercy. As long as the Pharisee maintained his attitude, he would never be a good influence on others. He would taint, he would corrupt his family, his children, and everyone he would encounter. The tax collector was concerned with fixing himself. If he could fix himself, he would be doing his best to influence and to help everyone else in his life. Parents have responsibilities toward their children. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Notice that the text says to fix yourself first in verse 6. These words I command you shall be in your heart. And then verse 7, seek to influence your families and others. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. But it's to be with you first. And then the same thing with verses 8 and 9. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes. And then, verse 9, you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. It's to start with you and extend outward from there. Fathers are responsible for what goes on in the home, but when a father or a mother tries to control every thought, every word, every action of a child, most children will push back. The children who won't push back usually push back later. With a controlling parent, you will have constant conflict in that home. Henry Blackaby once said, there are many children in whose lives God cannot work because the parents are constantly getting in the way. In our efforts to control things and in our efforts to control others, we need to remember who's truly in charge. We need to treat others with the recognition that we answer to a higher master, and so does everyone else. Ephesians 6, verses 5 through 9, speaking to slaves. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. Serve them sincerely as you would serve Christ. Try to please them all the time, not just when they are watching you. As slaves of Christ, do the will of God with all your heart. Work with enthusiasm as though you were working for the Lord rather than for people. Remember that the Lord will reward each one of us for the good we do, whether we are slaves or free. Masters, verse 9 says, Masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Don't threaten them. Remember, you both have the same master in heaven, and he has no favorites. In Romans 14, Paul is warning some Christians not to condemn other Christians for refusing to participate in things they thought were wrong when there was in fact nothing wrong with those activities. Romans 14, verse 4 and verses 10 through 12 says, Who are you to condemn someone else's servant? Their own master will judge whether they stand or whether they fall. And with the Lord's help, will stand and receive his approval. So why do you condemn another believer? Verse 10 says. Why do you look down on another believer? Remember, we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For the scriptures say, As surely as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bend to me and every tongue will declare allegiance to God. Verse 12 says, Yes, each of us will give a personal account to God. Stop trying to control others. They will answer to God as well as you. We must learn to surrender control to God. Mark 8, verses 34 through 37, when Jesus had called the people to himself after speaking alone with his disciples, he said to them, Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. He's talking about surrendering control. Verse 35, For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? When we try to control others, we make a mess of things. When we try to control everything around us and everything in our lives, we make a mess of things. The only way to find peace, the only way to find contentment, the only way to find forgiveness, the only way to find hope is to lay everything at the foot of the cross, to recognize that God is the one who is in control. When the guards were coming to arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, in Luke 22, verse 53, Jesus said to them, This hour and the power of darkness is yours. He was saying, I'm giving you this hour. I'm giving you control. From your perspective, today you win. Go ahead, do it. This is the one who fed thousands with a few pieces of bread and a few small fish. This is the one who healed the blind and raised the dead. Yet he's saying, go ahead. We continue reading in Matthew 26, verses 51 through 53. We're told, One of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Jesus said to him, Put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? This is the one who could call thousands. We sing the song. He could have called 10,000 angels. 12 legions is closer to something like 60 to 70,000 angels, but 10,000, 70,000, one. Who's counting? What power? What authority? Jesus knew that his Father was in charge. And basically he was saying, if I'm in my Father's hands, and if my controllers, the people who want to destroy me, are in my Father's hands, I'm content. Because if all this is in my Father's control, it does not have to be in my control. Like King Saul, we're all in trouble when we find ourselves trying to control things that we simply can't control. We can't control the weather. Have you ever gotten upset because the weather ruined your plans? Might as well get mad at the sun for shining. It's an exercise in futility. You need to relinquish control. We can't control the stock market. We can do a lot more than we think, perhaps, regarding our health, but we cannot always control our health and a lot of other things. And we certainly can't control people. Might control their outward movements, but you don't control what's going on in their minds and in their hearts. When we refuse to accept things that are not completely in our control, we become bitter, we become resentful. And though that only puts things further out of our control, again, we can't control others, but with God's help, we can control our own attitudes. We can control our own choices. We can control, we can regulate, we can choose to serve God. And when we make that our priority, we will exert the best possible influence on others. And by making submission to God our priority, we will know a peace that surpasses understanding, and we'll begin to glorify God in our lives. Back in 1902, a woman by the name of Adelaide Pollard was at a prayer meeting. And in that prayer meeting, someone prayed, "It really doesn't matter what you do with us, Lord. Just have your own way with our lives." That phrase stuck in her mind, and later that evening she wrote a poem. And 5 years later, George Stebbins wrote a tune he called Adelaide, and that poem was set to music. It's a familiar hymn. Have thine own way, Lord. Have thine own way. Thou art the potter, I am the clay. Mold me and make me after thy will, while I am waiting, yielded and still.